everyone. Welcome. Can you hear me? My name is Dale Del Owenthal. I'm Professor of Psychotherapy and Counselling at the University of Roehampton. We've got a star-studded panel for you. We're looking at critical psychotherapy, yeah? And we're looking tonight at the many faces. Yeah? I was saying to somebody, it's not only two-faced, it could be four-faced this evening. I'm going to give a brief introduction, and then Michael Rustin here, Professor of Sociology at University of East London, will be talking on working contemporary capitalism. Stephen Groak, where's Stephen? Here. Stephen is Professor of Social Thought at University of Roehampton, will be talking about psychoanalysis and resistance. And Andrew Samuels here, who's a Professor of Analytic Psychology at Essex University, will be talking about the active mind. So, we're fortunate also that this has all come from this book, which I've edited, which they are contributing to. And there may be other people in the audience here who are also contributing or speaking tomorrow. Adrian, where's Adrian? Adrian, yeah, from here, from Toronto for this. So, and I don't know, is Julie here? Hello.
Hi.
So Julie Walsh from Warwick, will also be speaking tomorrow. So
Saturday,
thank you very much.
You're
tomorrow and critical Saturday. That's our programme. In fact, what happened was two of the speakers this evening couldn't make Saturday because of prior arrangements, and that's why Ivan's very kindly thought of us doing it this evening. So with regard to this book, I think one of the questions is really whether we've been caught up too long with individualism, pseudoscience, and the language of medicine and clinical psychology. And that's got compounded with the increasing role of the state. So I'm just going to say a few things. So that's the book. You can buy it outside here, along with lots of other books from the speakers. And we're finishing just before 9 o'clock. Don't forget to go and buy a few books before you go. So there's a question, are we becoming far too much more of the problem than the solution? Are we really getting caught up in a form of social control to really make sure nothing too much happens? Yeah? So what are the forces in our society that's made, for example, CBT, which I'm not against CBT, but a movement really to help people take their minds off their problems? Why is that so prevalent? Why do we have such absurd notions as randomised controlled trials as being the gold standard, the so-called evidence-based? Yeah? This is, anyone I think getting a GCSO level in maths will realise that you can't use randomised controlled trials for talking therapies. So, our psychiatry and psychology, can we see those as really primary agents of the state? Yeah? Where very bright people get their heads filled up with loads of stuff that's perhaps not very relevant. And is that happening to the psychological therapists? What is the future? Where are we, as psychological therapists, with the medical model, the DSM, with its wondrous invention of even more categories that are not based on very much? Where is psychoanalysis in all this? What's going to happen to psychoanalysis? Where is science anywhere if at all? And should it be there at all? So, a lot of what is in the book might have been seen as talked about by Paul Ricoeur in his Hermeneutics of Suspicion. And Paul Ricoeur, just to remind you, says what we should be up to is a method of interpretation, which assumes that the literal surface-level meaning of the text is a method to conceal the political interests which are served by the texts. Yeah? So the purpose of interpretation is to strip off the concealment, unmasking those cover stories. So could we see, for example, from Karl Marx and others, how capitalism affects our well-being, through Nietzsche, how morality is man-made, and through Freud, the secrets of our sexuality. So could all three of us free ourselves up? Not completely, but to some extent, when we're a bit less subject to. We're always going to be subject to it, but a bit less. I mean, I just gained talking with some students today. If a parent sort of comes to see a psychological therapist with an anxiety that they've had a dream of some sexual intercourse with one of their children, what would happen? Is the therapist able nowadays? Are they trained? Have they had any therapy? It's possible to be on the registers of most places as psychotherapists without much in the way of therapy yourself. Would that person then get reported? Would they be stupid to raise those questions these days with a psychological therapist? It seems that people are trained over, it's confidential so long as you don't say anything that harms you or that could be just about anything, or anyone else. And so what kind of, this kind of space that we're creating where things could be spoken of, couldn't be spoken about elsewhere, seems less and less possible. So there's been a transformation, as somebody else has said, in what we're doing from cottage industry to factory-based production. We are now manualising. We're partly manualising in order to do the research methods that won't work in any case. And we're also manualising because it's cheaper to train technicians. What sort of effects is that having on the nature of our work and the quality of our lives? Let alone, are we going to have an even worse experience of alienation when we need it? So one of the things new is the extent of the state's involvement in purchasing, providing specific psychological therapies. This is in a new era of neoliberalism with its audit culture. And in the UK, is what is referred to as new public management with its markets, managers and missions. So we may see two parallel developments. On the one hand, we have neoliberalism encouraging the privatisation of everything public and the commercialisation of all things private. And we also have this sort of notion of the state tightening its grip on the psychological therapist in the name of safeguarding the public. So what do we do? Do we do nothing? Do we try and change the way, for example, NICE is producing its recommendations, the language, the ridiculous composition of its guidance development groups, the use of the RCTs? Do we try and do something about that? Do we take here, for example, Peter Fonagy's advice, and not try and fight this, but try and come alongside it, and do manualised training? Or do we help stimulate a very different potential cultural change? Try and critically develop our own work to help those who want to explore personal meaning. And for research, to stick to case studies. Stick to what comes out of our own work and try and avoid the external imposition of measurement on it. Well, just to end, if we were to have a manifesto, could we consider what about the threats that are very much there in us not being able to provide a confidential space? Can we resist those? With regard to the training of talking therapists, should we be looking more at the social situations people are in? Should we train therapists to know more about sociology, anthropology, economics, including ideology? Should we continue to explore in our work case studies, not randomised controlled type trials? We perhaps must be very wary of state interventions, the DSM, which threaten the pluralism of our approaches. Can we really say there's only one or two games in town? In some ways, aren't they all ridiculous? All these cultural practices. That's what they are. They're cultural practices that you can't measure when you're in them. And maybe the research methods are all also cultural practices to meet the dominant forces in our society. Perhaps talking therapists need to be able to work with their and others' sexuality and violence. We need to look at that within ourselves if we're going to hear it in others. And when we encourage assertiveness, autonomy, and individualism, we may perhaps need to think more about heteronomy. A French recent philosopher has talked about the modernity of altruism, or at least religion would talk about in terms of the common good. Well, there's an introduction to some of the things that we're going to tell you about. So I hope they haven't switched off completely by now. So we're going to have three people speaking, and they're going to speak for about 25 minutes. If there's time within the 25 minutes for questions, then we'll ask a few. There'll be space for questions, but otherwise there'll be over half an hour at the end for you to for us to have a debate and see what you think about these various ideas of critical psychotherapy. Well, our first speaker is Michael Rustin, and Michael's going to explore with us the critical psychotherapy in terms of work in contemporary capitalism. Michael.
Okay, well, I am really going to talk about work in contemporary capitalism. I'm going to be talking in the most big picture way, which I think may be not a bad thing at the very beginning of this 2 days of events. And I'll come to psychotherapy itself rather later in the talk. The first thing to talk about is the fact that the situation of those who live by work in Western capitalist societies is getting worse and has been getting worse for many decades compared with those who live by capital. This is even true of people's absolute situation, but it's certainly true of their relative situation. And of course, the landmark study which has drawn attention to this situation, becoming a bestseller in doing so, rather amazingly, is Thomas Piketty's extremely large and very fully researched book, Led Capital in the 21st Century, whose title, of course, echoes Karl Marx's Das Kapital. The essential finding of this book, so far as our topic of work is concerned, is that there's been a long-term shift in the division of income and wealth between those who live by their income from their labour and those who live through their ownership of capital. What is also associated with this is an increasing steepness of the income inequality gradient, with the top 10%, indeed the top 1%, having an increasing share of national wealth, especially in Britain and the United States, and in other so-called advanced countries too, in part due to the very high incomes of those in top managerial positions, corporate, chief executive, and so on. You'll know Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett's work on inequality in books such as The Spirit Level, which is convergent with Pickett's argument. Their thesis is that the steeper the gradient of inequality in society, the worse it is in terms of average indicators of health or ill health, addictions, crime, obesity, and violence for everyone, because, they say, of the humiliation, disrespect, and lack of autonomy that high levels of inequality inflict on those at lower levels of the hierarchy. And of course, in hierarchies, nearly everybody's at a lower level in relation to somebody. It's arguable that these problems also impose themselves on those high up in anxiety, fear, and guilt, and their need to exclude themselves from the dangers of the larger, rough population. Those of you who have the good fortune, which may mean being of an age, to already own flats or houses in London or the South East, may well have noticed that the rate of increase in the value of your properties will have far outrun any regular annual increase in your wages or salaries in recent years. This tendency may have been disguised for individuals by particular career successes or promotions. Indeed, it's possible you earn more money through the increase in value of your flat or house than you earn through your salary. You don't have to have a terribly valuable house in London for people on moderate professional income for that to be the case. Without transfers of family capital from parents or grandparents, it's now very hard for young people to afford home ownership, which is, of course, the principal capital asset in a lifetime for most people. There's obviously a very large generational dimension of this, which lies in wait, as it were, as a political divide at some point, between young people and old people, who are people of my generation and people 20 years younger than me, have been very, very favoured by the circumstances of the post-war period. All this is really, thus we return to a society in which more and more property will be inherited. Back to the 19th century, as Pickett says, and as George Osborne's idea of permanent balanced budgets, last seen in about 1880, echoes. Now, Piketty's argument is that capitalism has a long-term tendency to increase capital's share of wealth distribution, offset to some degree by population growth, and there's substantial increases in population, these capital growth effects are diminished, and by growth in the economy. this tendency was arrested, that's to say the unequal balance tendency was arrested for various reasons between 1910 and 1950. I was surprised it was as early as 1910, but it was. Since 1970, there has been a continuing recovery of the share of capital, that's to say assets of various kinds, in national wealth, in contrast to incomes from wages and salaries. In part, this is the consequence of the privatisation of formerly public assets, which is a net contributor to substantial inequalities between those who own capital and those who don't, and through rises in asset values, shares, landed property, houses, and so on. Now, both economic growth and population growth in advanced countries, economies such as Europe and the United States, is now remarkably slow compared with what it was 20 years ago, and the prospects of reversing this trend now seem poor, without substantial governmental action of which there seems no likelihood from any political quarter. Piketty argued that it would need persistent government action regarding taxes on capital and property and effective inheritance taxes to reverse this tendency. It must be said that the public political debate, as seen in the general election a few weeks ago, has largely failed to catch up with or take note of these dismal findings, which seem to be a reality that few people actually wish to recognise. Let's look now at the decline of middle-income employment. A second broad development relevant to our specific discussion of the place of psychotherapy is the decline, in particular, of skilled middle-income employment, both of professionals and skilled workers. This is in part a consequence of technological rationalisation. It's the tendency of market economies, as we know, to produce, or to drive to produce, goods and services for the lowest cost. Obviously, capitalism, the drive to increase return on private investments, is the great driver of this. Harry Braverman's Labour and Monopoly Capitalism, an excellent book, made this argument most effectively in the 1970s. Automation of manufacturing processes is one aspect of this. The computerisation of administrative processes is another. So, Oyster cards enable buses and tubes to be operated without ticket inspectors or even ticket salespeople. Tax returns can be made before January the 31st online. Bank accounts can be managed and money transferred online. Internet shopping replaces retail staff with computer systems. Giant warehouses coordinated by computer and with postal delivery systems employing relatively low-level employees. Public sector organisations, as we know, are also driven by the demand to produce their goods and services at the lowest cost. For example, those in universities and further education will know this. So the effect of all this has been to hollow out the middle of the labour market, reducing the bargaining power and skill of those with experience or skills in many sectors. Only at the least skilled end of the labour market, and perhaps at the very top end, in the command and control segment, as it were, that's to say, as far as the low end is concerned, in the hospitality, tourism and care sectors, for example, is a rising demand for labour maintained. These are operations which resist automation, or which require person-to-person attention, like social care, or indeed schooling, or care in the early years. But the vast increase in formal education which has taken place at the same time means that there is little scarcity of supply of person power with sufficient skills to fill these niches. Thus, in many of these sectors, wages and salaries are driven downwards. People have to settle for insecure part-time work or even the infamous zero-hour contract in which there is no guaranteed availability of work at all. The neoliberal doctrine that labour, capital and commodities should all be free to move at will enforces this market discipline. And merely restricting the flow of migrants while allowing capital to circulate around the world whenever it wants would not solve this problem. If scarcity of labour then reduced the return on capital, capital would move away. Part of this situation is the result of a global shift arising from the instituting of the free flow of capital and the financialisation of the world economy from the 1980s, under Thatcher and Reagan to begin with. Many industrial and indeed service jobs lost in the West have been transferred to emerging economies. So the overall division of wealth between capital and labour may be slightly different if you include the emerging skilled workers and middle classes of China and India in the picture. But for the moment, let's concentrate on Europe and America, which is where most of us probably are. In regard to the transfer of work to emerging countries, I was recently asked to correct some proofs from a journal, I think it was edited by Blackwell, not even your journal, formerly a proud Oxford institution, for a computer now owned by Wiley, a multinational, from an office in India. I was surprised to discover that I was returning my proof to India. But even though incomes from labour have certainly been rising, the large segments of, I've just made that point about India and China might be different. This is all very little comfort to those earning their living in the United Kingdom, or looking for work in the United Kingdom, or leading university, especially in parts of the United Kingdom outside the rather privileged bubble of London and the South East. So in thinking about what's happening to work, of which psychotherapy is one variety, we need to have in mind this very large and depressing trend. It is interesting, however, that Piketty's thesis should have attracted the amount of attention it has, and by no means only on the political left. And I've not seen that his major findings have been seriously disputed by anybody. There have been arguments about particular bits of data, but not, I think, about the overall issue. Well, that's the topic of these 2 days' events, which is critical psychotherapy. Let's look at the impact of all this on the specific occupations of psychotherapists. There are several dimensions to this. Not only connected to the developments I've described, but you'll see the broad picture. There is, in the first place, a substantial contraction going on of the availability of psychotherapy in the National Health Service. For example, analytic psychotherapy for children and adolescents for several decades was a nearly wholly public sector National Health Service practice. I've had a lot to do with this in the development of support or research work connected with child psychotherapy at the Tavistock Clinic just down the road. Few child psychotherapists for decades had or expected to have private practices for their work with children. Child analysis at the Institute of Psychoanalysis, which is primarily private, had virtually disappeared, despite the importance of Anna Freud, Melanie Klein, and Donna Winnicott to the development of British psychoanalysis. And now I understand matters are becoming different. Because of cuts in staff in NHS clinics, and the view that individual psychotherapy for children is too expensive to provide, so that it's impossible for psychotherapists to do the work that they were trained for, many child psychotherapists, I understand, are leaving the NHS, or thinking of leaving the NHS. And it's becoming common, and it never used to be, so I'm advised, to envisage or plan a private practice career while training. Now there's also, as Dale has mentioned, a process of rationalisation and efficiency drive, such as we see in other parts of the economy, now pervading mental health provision. The criterion of evidence-based practice rules out dynamic therapies as unproven, even though actually the evidence for them is as positive as it is for other therapies. I don't have much confidence, I may say, that scientific evidence by itself will make much difference to what happens. Ideology and professional competition is more powerful, although I don't share Dell's view that randomised controlled trials are pointless or misguided or ineffective. It seems to me I know of two good randomised controlled trials on 1 year of once-weekly child psychotherapy, which are producing, I think, well, one of them has already produced, well, adult psychotherapy, good results. I'm hopeful that the other will also produce good results. The problems about what you can do with those trials and so on, which we can discuss and I mention in a minute, but I do think they do provide a form of evidence which does count in the nice struggles and so on and so forth, but I also think that the primary drivers and determinants of what gets provided are more to do with ideology and professional competition than they are with the scientific basis. So that's another question. I regard these adaptations of attempting randomised controlled trials to be a reasonably constructive thing to do, and I certainly don't think there's anything wrong with trying to be cost-effective. Resources are scarce, and there are more patients than there is treatment for, so I don't hold a view against that. But nevertheless, the general current drive is to attack specialist skills in preference to generic ones, to prefer short-term treatments, and generally to deny the existence of the serious mental health problems which psychodynamic problems can successfully treat, and in fact, more successfully treat than other methods of psychotherapy. So, given those overall pressures, it is a very hard time to be qualifying as a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. Now, on the other hand, there is a large population in this country and in the United States which is rather well-educated, nearly half the population of 18-year-olds, you know, have some kind of higher education. And this population, at least, have quite high aspirations regarding the quality of emotional and personal life that they would wish to have. I might say in Bourdieu's terms, the sociologist, that there is a significant segment of the population which is quite rich in cultural capital and aspiration, though low in material capital, i.e. money and economic security. There is thus a demand for psychotherapies, even if the public sector is increasingly unwilling or unable to pay for it. There's a sort of opportunity here, actually, for a growth in private practice psychotherapy, filling a kind of space like private school, like school coaching for people anxious about their kids, or niche restaurants or boutique shops. This niche for the many victims there will be of the harshness and instrumentalism of the neoliberal system. So one might predict in this economic environment that I've described that private psychotherapy and private and psychotherapy provided by charity, by non-governmental organisations, may well find itself in a niche which is actually growing. That's not the picture that I had when I got involved in working in relation to psychotherapy in the Tavistock Clinic, when our vision was of an inclusive public service to which all those people in mental health need will have access. And that's what seems to me to be, at this point, in grave jeopardy. Now, psychotherapy is an entirely interesting occupation, since it allows a high degree of variety, intensity of experience, and autonomy for those who practice it. So there is a demand for psychotherapy, both on the client side, but also on the provider side, on the supply side. And one might predict that psychotherapy will continue to have, for these reasons, a significant presence in this society. But as I've said, it might be likely to be, given the political dispensation we now have, that's a big question, of course, the province of private practice, the quasi-charitable work. Of course, one has to note that this is where psychotherapy mainly began in the interwar period. The welfare state was the exceptional period, as far as the psychotherapy is concerned. I would personally not be worried about the idea of measurement and accountability for results if the broad intention and goal was to meet the mental health needs of a population, as this is broadly understood. I do think large randomized controlled trials have huge limitations, since they submerge all the differences there are between patient population and their actual treatment. You treat 500 people for serious depression, but how much do you learn about the differences between the 500 people in the course of this process? Actually, very, very little, because of the aggregating effects of this whole methodology. It does tell you something valuable about what can work and so on and so forth, but it also costs a vast amount of money, millions and millions of pounds, to produce not that much information about the specifics and the differences among the ways patients respond to what kind of treatment. It occurred to me that one response to the evidence-based mania, while I'm, as I said, reasonably supportive of the two major trials that I know about, and also the reviews of the other trials that one of my colleagues at the Tavistock, Eilish Kennedy, has done, the systematic reviews of the literature are quite positive and encouraging, actually, about the efficacy of psychotherapies. So while I'm quite supportive of those, it did occur to me that there might be a different kind of response to the evidence-based mania, which would be to encourage or enable psychotherapists to think more critically about their own capacity, case by case, to assess how well they are doing individually with their patients, so that evidence becomes more case-based, a matter of practitioners' attitudes and approaches, rather than a statistical aggregation, which, as Estelle says, is never going to work very well with mental illnesses, which don't lend themselves to statistical aggregation or standardisation in the way that it seems that medical illnesses, physical illnesses, to a degree do. We do know that the success rate of hip operations is 85% or something. We are never going to know that about serious mental illness. It seems to me, given any reasonable definition of what counts as improvement or cure. So one aspect of being critical in psychotherapy would be to ask psychotherapists and their trainings to become more self-critical about their techniques and experiences with patients. And my picture of the way psychotherapists are trained is, on the whole, that's not the emphasis. They do learn, and are encouraged to learn about their patients and about their techniques, but I think the question, how well did I do with this patient and why, doesn't seem to me to be a central question which people are asked to answer in the course of their training. And I wonder whether there might be something useful in effect. Now, psychotherapy does, of course, enable the stresses and harms brought about by social systems, such as the one I've described, to be understood in great depth. Another version of a critical psychotherapy would be to encourage psychotherapists to function as practical, i.e. clinical researchers, into the problems which arise through the functions and malfunctions of institutions such as prisons, which are absolute reservoirs of serious mental ill health, schools, which produce great stresses, universities, which also produce stresses, workplaces, hospitals. In other words, to think of psychotherapy as a source of witness, report, and analysis to bring out what you might call the C. Wright Mills sociologist once put it, the public dimensions of private problems. So psychotherapists do potentially have a role as contributors to our understanding of the way this kind of society affects its citizens. Now, I think we have to attend to this larger field of social and economic changes, which one can summarise, as Dell has done, under the label of a neoliberal regime, if we're to understand the problem being experienced in the field of psychotherapy and mental health. It's a broad challenge to this entire definition of the social and economic good that is needed. Now, it may be that those who know about mental health, surely one of the side effects of this social system can contribute some distinctive knowledge and experience to the construction of such a challenge with the broad range of alliances and dialogues and discussions and so on that's needed, far beyond what any political party can now even begin to think about if any serious change in this political social culture is going to come about.
Thank you. In this case, Mike's finished 5 minutes early, so we have another mic.
Oh, here you go.
Any questions or any comments?
Well, I wonder if you could possibly say a little bit more about this notion of a psychotherapist acting as a kind of witness to institutions like
you could start with school counsellors. Supposing you invited a group of school counsellors, psychodynamic school counsellors, to talk about what they currently experience the stresses upon kids and teachers in schools to be, and you asked them to produce a paper, a conference, a discussion about that in the context of educational discussion, that would be an example. Or imagine people working as psychotherapists in prison, imagine them making a contribution to the dysfunctionality of the prison system. In the way that it works. So I'm thinking of this in a diagnostic way. You could also imagine people doing good work in trying to do things in different ways. I work as a sort of research consultant, if that's the right word, to a project at the Brent Centre, which has been running a kind of group therapy for young offenders. Now, the youth offending treatment system is actually probably the best bit of the criminal justice system. So these kids come for 10 or so consultations. And the idea is, if you provide these kids with space to think, and with somebody who seems to be interested in them, and who remembers them from week to week, and wants to see them 6 weeks after they finish their course, maybe you make a difference to those kids. And actually, my impression is that they are making a difference to those kids. So you find an example of how a more humane and thoughtful way of bringing insight to bear on the problems that people have got themselves into, because there isn't any doubt that these kids have got themselves into a problem. Fortunately, for many of these kids, it's a problem for which there is a potential recovery, because the notion of community sentencing that they've got is a relatively intelligent and thoughtful one, preventive one. That would be an example. So we've got an example of various examples of social diagnosis as produced through the reflections of psychotherapists, and an example of social intervention produced by psychotherapists.
Mike, just following on that, with regard to social intervention, what extent can psychotherapists play a part in social intervention? Not as much as some people here, but I've worked in prisons, and where it's quite wrong to put the emphasis on that the individual prisoner could rectify their own. I was working with young people who were in prison, a young person's prison, and the last thing they wanted to do was to go back to where they'd come from. Didn't seem to be any other alternative. And, you know, the issue wasn't them having therapy, it was some sort of social intervention that was almost too late for them. As a psychotherapist, what could I do?
Well, as far as prisons, I was primarily talking about what psychotherapists could contribute to the understanding of what one might call the emotional and psychic life of people in that situation. I think there is evidence actually from some of the therapeutic prison systems that have operated, like Brendan Underwood and the Pepper Harrow for adolescents, that actually group therapeutic approaches to people in those situations are actually effective. So I don't agree with you that you can't do anything effective in a therapeutic mode with people in that situation. But open-minded about that, don't know about it. What I'm actually saying, though, is that I think that psychotherapists do have a potential contribution to make in helping people to understand what is actually going on, and I think describing and saying what's going on is one of the ways of producing somewhat different attitudes to the situation. But, you know, everybody knows, in a certain, some people know, and some people say, that about at least a third of the people who are in prison shouldn't be there at all. So the question is, how do you continue to make that argument and demonstrate the evidence which supports that view, such that a change in the prison system might be imaginable?
So it's not that individual's responsibility that they're in prison, but also a social responsibility as well. But Andrew, you have.
Michael, this is about the possible boom in private practice psychotherapy, because I've had to think about this a lot in my various jobs recently. I want to make two rather downer type remarks. The first is that what happens to psychotherapy in the public sector affects what happens in the private sector, and so CBT practitioners in Harley Street and Devonshire Place are doing very well. And indeed, CBT practitioners all over the country are doing very well in private practice because the customers read off from the socially authoritative discourse in which depth therapy, relational therapy, is deprecated. That's the first reason why we need to be cautious. The second is that the clients are not interested in whether the psychotherapy they purchase is psychodynamic, psychoanalytic, Jungian, humanistic, integrative, Rogerian, person-centered. And in your talk, I felt that you conflated psychotherapy and counselling and the psychodynamic or even psychoanalytic approach thereto. And I think that is one of the biggest problems, the tribal infighting that has gone on, means that, especially for people who want to do depth work, we're finding that, understandably, the clients will go to humanistic psychotherapists who are less posh, less distant, less in their heads, and altogether more appealing as therapists. So for two reasons, I'm extremely and unhappily cautious. The first is what happens at the state level inflects what happens at the private level. And the second is that the schoolism, as the late Patricia Clarkson called it, the tribalism, must be dealt with by us if we want to have any kind of movement for real psychotherapy.
Well, what I would say to that is I think people find their way to psychotherapy by many different routes. There are many different clusters of opinion in the country, in schools, in medical practices and so forth. And some people will find their way to drugs, and some people will find their way to CBT, but some people will find their way to psychoanalysis. And the fact that the culture remains quite strong and quite humanistic in many ways, think of the popularity of cultural festivals and the prestige and authority that writers and novelists have compared with politicians and so forth, you can see how the possibility of maintaining a continuing interest in psychotherapy of an analytic kind is likely to continue, and some people will find their way to it. I'm trying to diagnose the situation. I'm making a prediction that I think that psychotherapy will be more likely to find growth and development outside the public sector at this moment than it will inside the public sector, because of the commitment that the government has actually to squeeze the public sector to the point of near death in these kinds of areas. This is a prediction, and I think what will come out of that are some spaces where people can do good work. Some people will set up, you know, Camden's Centre for Psychotherapy and the Women's Psychotherapy Centre, and some people will set up good institutions which will do good things. And that means I don't think psychotherapy and psychoanalysis will actually die under this pressure. I think they will migrate to a different situation. Now, my commitment was always to a public sector National Health Service provision. I had a conversation with my wife Margaret about this the other day. She said, well, she's now seeing quite a lot of private patients because she's retired. And she said, I'd rather not be paid for any of it. I'd rather do all of this for the Tavistock if I could, you know, but it's not possible. The reality is that there are patients there are people who find their way to these kinds of treatment, and in my opinion will continue to be. And since I think the cultural space for an interest in fulfillment, emotional quality, depth, understanding remains quite large, even under this regime, I myself think that space remains a potentially large one.
Michael, thank you very much. We'll return to these questions later. Well, we'll come back, as Stephen said, to what he's speaking of in the plenary session. So, Andrew Samuels is going to talk about the activist fund. Thank you.
Thanks. First of all, congratulations to Dell for yet another magnificent edited volume, almost as good as the previous edited volume, which he co-edited with me. I'm going to talk on a clinical theme, because I was a bit worried that this whole thing, this whole idea of crystal psychotherapy would become a kind of academic wank, and it wouldn't have a clinical reference at all. Just would like to know, who here is a therapist, or training to be therapist, or clinician of some kind? Define it as you like. Almost everybody could. That's nice. But before I start to talk about a clinical theme, I think I need to tell you that, and I'll do it in this graphic way. On June 26th, in a few days' time, there will be a protest outside Streatham Job Centre at which psychotherapists and counsellors, there as psychotherapists and counsellors, will be protesting at what has been called the psychologisation of unemployment, which needs to be added to the psychologisation of poverty and of disability, and indeed of mental health itself. If you want your full benefits, and this was on page 28 of the Tory manifesto, you will need to have compulsory therapy. It will be provided by an IAPT, Improving Access to Psychological Therapies practitioner, and it will be manualized CBT, not even real CBT. The ethics of this, surely, to this audience, do not require further elaboration. If you want to find out about this protest, email me, andrew@andrewsamuels.net, on June the 20th. For the first time in my experience, under the banner of the Alliance for Counseling and Psychotherapy, therapists will be marching with the People's Assembly against austerity, starting outside the Bank of England and going via Downing Street to Parliament. We've never had a banner before. It's been sewed by people who have taken off from trade union banners. It's a very interesting moment of resistance of another kind, perhaps. My chapter in Dell's book was entitled Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Therapy But Were Afraid to Ask, Fragments of a Critical Psychotherapy. And I admitted in the chapter that whatever critical might mean, the fact is that I wrote as an insider, and in fact I see tonight for the first time that I'm listed with insiders in the contents list. And it's true, I am an insider. I was chair of the UKCP, United Kingdom Council for Psychotherapy. I co-founded Psychotherapists and Counsellors for Social Responsibility, and I also co-founded the Alliance for Counselling and Psychotherapy. As a result of these august but actually meaningless honorifics, I was invited to do graduation addresses, and it was the graduation addresses that formed the basis of this essay into critical psychotherapy, because I was there talking to new entrants into the profession, which Michael Ruskin mentioned. The first graduation address was at the Westminster Pastoral Foundation, which is psychoanalytic psychodynamic. The second one was the Institute for Arts in Therapy and Education, which is creative arts therapies, and the third one was the Minster Centre, which is a humanistic and integrative training body. But I also feel I can write and speak as a critic, as someone who was a prominent member of the collective effort in 2010-11 that defeated the government's plans for statutory regulation of counsellors and psychotherapists. And then, as chair of the United Kingdom Council for Psychotherapy, I set up a campaign to challenge what is actually a scandal in relation to NICE's cooking of the books by restricting the research methodologies which they found acceptable in designating therapies as suitable. And in that campaign, I was greatly helped by Dell and by the Centre for Therapeutic Education at Roehampton, who wrote a magnificent paper that totally demolished all of NICE's arguments for the methodologies they were permitting. Earlier, in the mid-90s, I was one of the leaders of the move to end discrimination against lesbians and gay men, when they applied for or even contemplated training in psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic psychotherapy. This earned me the unending antipathy of the British Psychoanalytic Society and almost cost me my professorship at Essex when it was raised at my interview. So I think I'm a critic too. The talk is based on a section of the chapter in which I question the consensus that most of the therapists here will know about, the consensus that has built up around the therapy relationship and around the therapeutic alliance. The main aim of this short talk is to propose to you the idea of the activist client. This is not about clients who are already activists. What I'm saying is that some, maybe many, clients suffer from a kind of repression of their political selves. Others do have intense private political engagements, but doubt that they can, in the relevant phrase, make a difference. They are political, but it's secret. Yet all clients are citizens with the rights and responsibilities and limitations of citizens. So I hope that what I'm suggesting will resonate with a wide range of therapists and a wide range of clients. And by the way, I think it's better to call citizens clients rather than patients. The main psychological point is this. Social responsibility, freely and fully entered into by an individual, contributes to that individual's sense of vitality. Not only in Daniel Stern's sense of the vitality affect, but also in terms of life itself, of the principle of life itself. Social responsibility affirms the principle of life itself. And so what I'm saying could, I hope, perhaps contribute in a small way to a revitalization of democracy. Before getting to the activist client, I need to review briefly some of my previous experience and work that are relevant to the theme but which there isn't time to talk about. First, as many of you perhaps will know, because it's been embarrassingly public, I carried out a good deal of political consultancy advising leading politicians and their parties and also working with activist groups. What I say is grounded in these experiences. In particular, I seem to have gravitated to work in the general areas of leadership in the US and the UK, and to work in nationalism, national identity, and nation building in places like South Africa, Brazil, Poland, and Russia. Next, these are things I don't have time to talk about. Next, I've written a lot about how to work directly and responsibly with political, social, and cultural material in the clinical session, how to work directly but responsibly with political material. It is in fact available in no less than 5 different places because there's a real hunger for some kind of encouragement for therapists to do what they clearly want to do, which is to work with the whole client, including the client's political aspects. Thirdly, I've addressed and tried to address, really, the problem of one-size-fits-all universal psychologies. For example, when working to establish psychotherapy training in non-Western locations, some of you will know there is an unseemly imperialist rush. All the different schools get into a place like Russia. The Freudians, the Jungians, the Lacanians, the TA is very big in Russia. And we are competing with one another, just like the imperial and colonial powers did for Africa. The question is, what are we selling there? Is it a universal, one-size-fits-all psychology? Is there, in fact, sufficient questioning whether Western psychotherapy and its ideas and perspectives is, in fact, relevant to non-Western locations? And I would also like to say that I'm not sure that Western psychotherapy is altogether 100% relevant in many cultural locations in a country like Britain as well. Finally, I've discussed connections between economic inequality, social class, and psychotherapy. And in particular, I've been focusing on the emotional aspects of this question of inherited wealth, which Mike talked about. I'm exploring what it means psychologically to inherit, whether you inherit a lot, or quite a lot, or nothing. Focusing on the client.
we are seeing in the literature, and hence we may assume is taking place in practice to a degree, is the emergence of a rather new conception of the client. A perspective that sees the client as the motor of therapy. This client is a heroic client. A client who knows what she needs. A client who can manage her own distress. Some clients engage less in a process of healing or cure, and more in a process of ongoing personal and political inquiry. This multifaceted new client, author's point, is potentially a healer of others, especially of the therapist, and also of the world. Client as healer. Psychotherapy research isn't veridical, as we've been hearing, but it is interesting sometimes to look at the literature, not outcome studies, which are boring, but process studies and effectiveness studies. Summarizing a huge mass of research findings, John Norcross, who is my go-to researcher of choice, John Norcross has forced us to consider whether it is truly the therapy relationship that does the business. Is the private and highly personal therapy relationship the main thing that makes therapy work? Not really. In common with other leading researchers, such as Lambert and Wompold, that's the three, Lambert, Wompold, and Norcross are the three to read. Norcross summarizes that, quote, unexplained and extra-therapeutic factors amount to 40% of efficacy. This should make us very humble. He's saying that the best research shows that we don't know what makes therapy effective. Moreover, there may be a need to understand the effect factor as being extra therapeutic, nothing to do with the therapy at all. 40%. The client accounts for 30%. The therapy relationship for 12%. The actual therapist and the personality of the therapist, which is what we'd all love it to be bigger. 8%. And the school or tradition or modality, 7%. Now, Norcross would be the first to admit that therapy involves all of those things. And I would say that the findings do not do more than force us to consider our ideas about our clients. So let's take these findings, 30% to do with the client, as heuristic, stimulants to critical thinking about clients, which is what this is. Who are they? I don't mean who they are socioeconomically, but who are they as people? What do they want? And crucially, what point in their life journey have they reached? What stage have they reached in what Norcross calls their trajectory of change? It is humbling. It all depends on where the client is in their life, whether the therapy will be effective. As we know, there are some clients from whom one learns great and healing lessons. We heard that Freud learned a lot, theoretically, from working with hysteria. But this is personal. My first, what we used to call training case, I don't know if those of you who are in training, but you know, you have a training case. A training case is a case that you're going to be assessed on for your training. She had a dream very early on in the analysis. This was a long time ago, in the early 1970s, and she was coming four times a week, lying on a couch. It's a way of working I don't do anymore. She dreamt, very short, I visit a doctor who is ill in bed. He begs me to stay. Her associations to bed were of illness, not of sexuality. I knew better, of course, but didn't say anything. But how else can we understand this dream? Was the doctor, in fact, me? Or was this an assumption intended to justify what has been called a you-mean-me interpretation, better known perhaps as a here-and-now
transference interpretation, was it actually a cliche? Was the denial here in that she is the ill one, right? And I am truly the doctor? Or is she in the grip of an inflation of herself as the one who brings life and succor to me, more than a human lover? Or was this dream perhaps an accurate perception? I did need something from her, and not just that she stick with me so I could get through the training. Crucially, there would be a further accurate perception in the dream that she could, in fact, help and heal this doctor, me. But back in 1974, it was difficult to think of the client as healer. I'm not sure much has changed. But thinking of the client as healer, we see that recent critical thinking about the client has moved in that general direction. From the person-centered approach, we find Bohart and Tolman referring to the active client. Rogers, in the era when the discourse was of client-centered therapy, makes it clear that the client knows for herself what is needed, where she wants to go. Jung wrote of entropy in the client, an innate process of self-regulation. And from relational psychoanalysis, we read that Hoffman regards the client as having ethical responsibilities towards the analyst and the analysis, more than just for the co-creation of the therapy relationship. So what I'm saying to an audience that was 95% therapists is, in a way, that you are just adjuncts for the therapy process. Moreover, you are also contingent figures, product of a particular social circumstance. The therapist is socially sanctioned and granted permission to be a therapist, not only by society, but by the client. This is a new version of the client, a person who does not want the analyst to be the one who knows, or even the one who is supposed to know. That's passé from the point of view of these activist clients. Let's see what happens if we revision the therapy relationship with all of these thoughts about the client in mind. It has dawned on me, and I wonder what other therapists here think, it has dawned on me that clients sometimes just do not dare to show their knowledge and their emotional literacy. They are frightened to do it. It is not what they are there to do. And that we therapists, being human, being needy, we're cool about that because it leaves us free to do our work. But that could, and from critical and political perspectives, maybe should, change. I've been building up now to talk about the activist client. These observations on the politics of the therapy relationship lead me to make the suggestion that this new model client, this client as the motor of therapy, this client as healer, is increasingly a politically active and aware client. One possible development in therapy might be that during the work, the client will realize her capacities for alterity, meaning, amongst other things, an empathic concern for another. Yes, this does mean other people. But there is a more than personal version of alterity to consider. For example, in a multicultural world, meeting one's inner diversity could lead to support for outer cultural diversity, and hence to support for those hitherto subject to social exclusion. Or the therapy work, and it often does, may lead to a sharpening or awakening of latent political commitments, maybe entered into unconsciously without full buy-in from the conscious ego. So to the idea that the client is also a healer, we could now add that clients, and I will be bold and say potentially all clients, have the potential to be citizen therapists for the wider world with its environmental problems, economic injustice, and ubiquitous violence. The therapy client, revisioned as a socio-political healer, may now be understood to be a socially responsible agent of tikkun olam, the Hebrew phrase, meaning the drive to repair and restore the world. Back in 1975,
Searles wrote that paper, The Client as Therapist to His Enemies. If part of mental health is to want and be able to help and heal others, then isn't this something to work on in analysis? If so, said Searles, then isn't the obvious person to practice being a healer on your analyst? In a sense, I'm extending Searles' vision. His arc was the move from healing the analyst to healing other people. I extend it to embrace healing beyond specific human others, to reach out to the social and political crises of our times. This, I am saying, is good for the soul. Activism is good for the soul, mostly. Last section. This is called Emergence of an Activist Client, and it involves another dream. I wanted to let dreams carry this because I wanted to make it clear that working the socio-political is not antipathetical to working with depth dimensions. You don't need to become somebody who is just into communication and social problems. You can use dreams too. An Italian client dreamt of a beautiful lake with clear, deep water. He immediately said this represented his soul. The lake was the soul. And then immediately went on to associate to the high level of pollution on the Italian Adriatic coast at that time. The beaches were being clogged by a kind of algae. The image of the lake and his association to coastal pollution suggested in the form of one symbol the client's unconscious capacity for death, deep lake, and his present state, of which he was all too conscious, a state of being clogged up by algae like the coastal waters of the Adriatic. The client gradually became aware of the tension between the individual and the political presences of these images. What, the client and I asked together, what is the role of pollution in the soul, or even in the world? What is the role of pollution in the achievement of psychological death? Can the soul remain deep and clear while there is pollution in the world, in one's home waters? This is an Italian client living in London. Did the lake, with intimations of mystery and isolation, clash with the popular extroverted tourism of the Adriatic coast? Eventually, the client's concern moved on to the social level, and he rapped out, "Who owns this lake? Who should have access to such a scarce resource? Who will protect the lake from pollution?" These were his associations. From wholly personal issues, such as the way his problems were interfering with the flowering of his potential, we move to political and ecological issues such as the pollution of natural beauty, not only by industry, but by people, by the mass extroversion of tourism. And we move back again, too, from the political level to the personal level, including transference analysis. I do not mean to foreclose on other interpretations. I am a competent clinician. But rather, I want to add in this more political one, so that this client's, other clients, unconsciously taken up political commitments can become clearer. This client made a choice to return to Italy, to tell his father that he was gay, which is why he wasn't in Italy, and in his words, to, quote, get more involved, perhaps in environmental politics, which is what happened. In conclusion, I am not saying that every client should become an activist or that therapists should have such ambitions of a precise nature for their clients. What I am saying is that I have come to believe that many therapists fail to recognize the political dimensions of personal growth, and that failure is not helpful either to the project of therapy or to its clients. Thank you.
me join us up here. Okay, well, whilst you, I think you can hear me, can you?
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you think? I mean, do you think there's a need for us to think in terms of critical psychotherapy? Or do you think that, of course, if we do start thinking of critical psychotherapy, it will perhaps say that other psychotherapy is clearly uncritical. Do you think we need to really be worried about what's happening to us? And what do you think of the ideas that have been raised this evening? I mean, do you think that, for example, as Michael Rustin's saying, a lot of different things, but one of them is we should be more critical about ourselves, and perhaps, in particular, more critical about the gurus of our training program. You should say that directly, Michael, but, I would be putting that with it. And do you think that one thing Stephen was perhaps putting forward, that we can... Just the same way as perhaps psychoanalysis is really the teacher in psychoanalysis, though psychoanalysis in terms of the notion of resistance may provide us with new resistance to what is happening. Or with regard to what Andrew's saying, with regard to the activist client. I mean, for me that links very much to the problem of psychotherapy being about individualism normally and not about heteronomy, not about putting the other first. And to what extent should our values are always there in our work, but are our values less about the common good, more about our own selves? Less about putting others first. And does that come through to our clients, patients? Should we be looking at those values with them and in our society in general? There's just some thoughts, but before I invite the panel to respond to each other, some questions, some thoughts from you, please.
Hi. I'm not actually a psychoanalytic psychotherapist. I'm a systemic psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. And a couple of things that I picked up was the therapies and the ologies seem to me to have a responsibility to stop tribal warfare between ourselves, because we are in defence in some way around a broader notion of the human spirit as not something that can be commodified. And one of the books that I was reading in the NHS was called Intelligent Kindness, which talks again about the commodification of health. But actually what it's talking about is the commodification of the human endeavour in many different positions in which we are. I like the idea of resistance because it strikes me that we need to be resistant to some of the commodification that's occurring. And it just strikes me that unless somehow we create a dominant discourse around psychotherapy and the human spirit, that actually we will lose, or we will survive what is happening, but it will be to the detriment of a lot of people currently who are caught up in the social difficulties that the West is experiencing, where jobs are going elsewhere and we are, if you like, in decline. So there's something I find quite heartening about the discussion, which marries politics, sociology, the in-depth discussion of the human psyche and soul, and links it to some sort of social action. how that gets discussed in the dominant discourses of the day, God knows, but it strikes me as something that we have a responsibility to do.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Before I ask perhaps Pell to respond to that, would other people like to respond or ask another question first? Eric.
I'd like to ask another question and hopefully... I'd like to ask another question, if I may, and I'm interested in Steve's mention of helplessness. Perhaps we could hear some more about that. But I'm tying a couple of things that the speakers have said. If I start with Andrew's comment about affect and life as affect, there's an underlying theme then that seems to go ask the question of what is our affect about? And there seems to be two trajectories going on. One is transcendence and immanence, helplessness versus activism. And I'm not sure whether I've got the measure of what's being said in my comment, but there's something underlying what's being said here that seems to correspond to that. And these go back to being very much religious themes again.
Can we just take one more question and then ask perhaps the panel to respond? Is there another question or comment at this moment? Please.
Michael and Andrew sort of talked about the sort of psychoanalytic development being sort of translated into the sort of political realm, to put it in kind of Hegelian terms, if you'll excuse the wank. It was, that's sort of about mutual recognition, but the political realm is rather one of master-slave, so that those kind of issues about sort of respecting the other and those kind of things and understanding the other, if we look at it from a sort of Marxist perspective, don't really translate into that one, which is one of the sort of defeating an enemy, really.
Okay, so thank you. So we've got three perhaps quite different questions, although there's some links, I think, with regard to the human soul here in perhaps different ways and where that relates to religion and science and technology. But how can we, would somebody like to start to reply? Stephen,
you can start.
There was a specific question to you as well.
Yeah, that's helpful, Eric. I have to use this. I'm the only one without a mic. So, can you hear me at the back? Okay. If you cannot, just raise a hand. I won't say too much because I think it would be helpful to get more questions and more of a conversation. But I think helplessness goes along, really, with the concept of resistance. What's interesting after listening to Andrew's paper talk this evening is how different the approach and the address to the interface of the psychic and the social, the psyche and politics, is to the one that I was trying to refer to this evening, and I've tried to refer to at greater length in the book. For me, it's the idea, and I have to read the chapter and understand in more depth what Andrew is meaning by it. The activist client. But what I was doing with helplessness and resistance was bringing a vocabulary out of the analytic situation into the political domain. It seems to me, I mean, and this is not necessarily addressed to Andrew because I haven't digested what you've said in any kind of depth, but it seems to me disastrous to deploy political thinking in the analytic situation. Absolutely disastrous. So I think we have got a difference of opinion, to say the least. And I think the idea of helplessness, I was trying to remobilize a concept that's fundamental for Freud in 1895 in the project, and to try to demonstrate with that concept that these concepts are historically determined and they can only be used for critical purposes in a particular historical conjuncture. And so I was trying to bring that concept into a dialogue, a critical dialogue, with Levinas, and the notion of sacrifice, really, and how helplessness, or what I call in the chapter distress, for reasons that I think we probably haven't got time to enter here, again, form the basis for a critical strategy, which has nothing to do with the analytic situation. I'm not talking about patience. That's a practice which, for me, has its own integrity, its own space, outside of anything I was saying about political practice. That may put me in a minority, but it would be interesting to pull some of that out.
Could you just say something a bit more soon? Because the first person who spoke was talking about consumer relations. I've seen, possibly in relation to human relations. So if you had a patient who was sort of caught up in whatever consumer relations was, and you would speak of this in some way, would that be political?
Well, patients are caught up in consumer relations because we live in a capitalist society. So, I mean, that's a given.
It's not more than others.
Yeah, and it's a relationship. We have a kind of contractual relationship. Patients come and pay me money, and I take their money at the end of the month. It's a commodity. Now, you know, patients will bring material about paying money. And of course, I understand that they're talking about money, but they're also talking about things which have unconscious ramifications. And my responsibility then is to be an analyst, a psychoanalyst, and I think, you know, that's the politics of psychoanalysis, or the ethics of psychoanalysis, as I prefer to call it, as Lacan calls it. So my responsibility to the patient as a psychoanalyst, I mean, I'm not trying to blend or... is to listen to the patient's unconscious communications as I can.
So you wouldn't feel a responsibility for your patient's responsibility to others?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, it's the Levinas thing, it's really, it's that your responsibility could be for your patient's responsibility. So how they are with other people, yeah? Might be your responsibility as a psychoanalyst?
I don't know how they are with other people. I know how they
are. What they tell you about how they are with other people.
Well, all I know in the analytic consulting room is how patients relate to me. And then I analyse what that means.
Okay.
See, this is why critical psychotherapy is the fourth impossible profession. This kind of conservative and reserved approach, which you are only representing, I'm not saying that you're particularly in the grip of it. I've heard this for 30 years now. The split between a radical social perspective allegedly held by psychoanalysis and psychoanalysts and ultra-conservative clinical practices. This is really problematic. In fact, psychoanalysis is the symptom of psychotherapy, if you see what I mean. I'm speaking quite bluntly here. The history of clinical thinking is that yesterday's bad practice is today's good practice. Small children were once deemed unanalyzable. The psychotics and borderline patients were once deemed unanalyzable. The history of the clinical project is that what we are permitted and become expert in talking about in the therapy room changes historically over time. That is why political, social and cultural material needs to be addressed without prior interpretation. As Saddam Hussein is not your shadow. Mrs. Thatcher is not your mother. People often used to say that when people talked about Mrs. Thatcher, they were really trying to talk to the therapists about their mothers. I once said, well, actually, I think quite a lot of people talking about their mothers are struggling to talk about Mrs. Thatcher. There's a lot of psychological energy in the polis and in its antics and activities. The fantasy of a sealed vessel, of something neutral, of the analyst's responsibility, it needs to be critically confronted. Now, there is a problem. We are in Anna Freud's center. We are part of the Freud Museum. The speakers are two psychoanalytic types and one Jungian hybrid with relational psychoanalysis and humanistic psychotherapy. So it may be where we are that is a problem, but we are where we are, and therefore I want to slam down the challenge. If psychoanalysis simply goes on and on about what it is the proper duty, contractual duty of the psychoanalyst to do, then psychoanalysis will completely lose its credibility and its raison d'etre as a radical social critique. And I want to finish on this note. This is not just an attack on psychoanalysis, it's an attack on the institutions of psychotherapy, which I've been prominent in. You know, there were 450 psychotherapists, including Dell, who signed a letter objecting to compulsory therapy in job centres, or you have your benefits slashed. Five small radical psychotherapy organisations joined this letter. The British Confederation of Psychotherapy, which is the psychoanalytic one, the UKCP and the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy all declined, saying they knew very well where the writers of the letters were coming from, but they could not get involved in something so political. And when pushed on this, the BACP, with commendable honesty, said, you see, quite a lot of our members will want those jobs.
Okay, so but there's of course the other possibility that if psychoanalysis was to do what you're suggesting, Andrew, then perhaps it wouldn't be psychoanalysis.
Well, I want to say that I find myself very, very committed to particulars in this kind of discussion and very reluctant to get into general polemics about manifestos for this or that kind of psychotherapy. The fact of the matter is that there are many different streams and tributaries that make up this world, and the idea that there is a kind of common thing which everyone is going to agree about is about as unlikely as if you think about any other movement where, if you've been involved in politics, then the particular kind of differences that Andrew's identified between himself and orthodox organisations is completely familiar. That's what happens from the days of CND onwards. I find myself thinking about what Andrew has to say in terms of, well, okay, here is a description of a political way of conducting oneself with the notion of an activist client and this political potential being released by this process. Well, maybe. I'm open to the being persuaded or thinking that in cases of people who come, the people who work with Andrew, the contact, this works. He described a case, he described a client, whatever, who went back to Italy, who had some kind of liberation in relation to his family, who found some kind of involvement, fulfillment, or what have you in working in an environmental cause. In principle, I'm quite prepared to take that on as a possible version of how people might work. What I think is a bit unlikely is that that is how everybody's going to work, either clients or therapists, or indeed that they should. Something is a bit similar in relation to what Stephen has to say. He has a version of how psychoanalysis should be done. I don't know how far I really agree with that or not, but the test is always in the pudding is always in the eating. It's always what happens with this client or that client. And in regard to the question of the argument about psychoanalysis as a mode of resistance in itself, I think I don't understand that argument terribly well at this point, but I think we have to read the book to see what's being said. I'd say something similar about Dell's critique, which he was mentioning to me as I finished, about the randomised controlled trials. I'm not really interested in a general polemic. I know about three randomised controlled trials conducted by really scrupulous, capable psychotherapists or psychoanalysts with integrity, and I'm interested in knowing what happened to the patients and what happens to the results, and does it do any good? Is it worth the money? Which to me is, in a way, one of the questions. I think myself, these are specific questions. And at the level of the other discussion is really at the level of ideology, and I don't really think it's helpful to be involved with it. I just think one needs to think about the map is not the same as the territory. The territory is very diverse. There are many different kinds of patients, many different kinds of involvement, and many different kinds of meeting those kinds of situations, and they're best thought about in their particularities, and we just have to accept that we are going to have to work out lots of differences in relation to how each of us does different things and whether there are real commonalities in relation to specific projects and specific clinics or not. I've worked very happily at times with the family therapists at the Tavistock, even though I know that we basically deeply don't share some rather fundamental beliefs, really, about whether the unconscious really matters in the matter of work. But actually there's enough that we do share that I can work with them, and I have worked with them. And that's in a way that is how I actually think we should try to work, to find those areas of agreement that we can. Because I do think that faction fighting in the psychotherapy world is not a very helpful activity in general.
Let me do some bridge building.
I think that we're all guilty of exaggeration. I think Stephen's contract-based psychoanalytic approach is an exaggeration of something. Michael's, I've seen it all before, and everybody's different, and we need to respect particularities and not go in for ideology. That's an exaggeration. And my idea that there's something called the activist client is, of course, also an exaggeration. I don't want to quote Arthur Sayre because I don't think anybody really wants to hear about that.
Oh, right.
Well, didn't he say the only thing true in psychoanalysis are the exaggerations, and or something like that?
Adorno,
was it? Sorry. Well, anyway, the point I really want to say is that I recognise that my talk was, and how could I not recognise my talk was an exaggerated arrow fired at the centrality of the therapy relationship, the therapeutic alliance, and in its longer version, the transference-counter-transference dynamic as well. I don't see anything wrong with doing that. I think that's how the discipline moves, by argument, counter-argument.
Yes, counter-argument.
Not so much. Listening to his talk, I'm thinking that here in the audience, maybe in the position of a tourist on the streets of Dublin, who stopped a locum, asked for directions, and the Dubliner said, "I want to start from here."
Well, we have started our conference from here. We've run out of time. I don't know. I mean, I'm fascinated with the different talks people have given here. I hope, Mike, that I know you're very open-minded, but what do we call ideology? Is it other people's views? No? I'd say randomised control trials are a good example of ideology in practice. But I think the thing is that with regard to critical, and of course, one of the things is critical theory and Adorno, which has just been mentioned, with regard to many different takes on critical, I hope you're able to be here on Saturday, and if not, buy two copies of the book find out more. I think what isn't, for me, an exaggeration is the massive change that is taking place in what was psychotherapy, psychoanalysis, counselling, and counselling psychology. I think it was okay, it could let it be when it was a few people in NW3 and one in Devon. But as the Guardian says, 1 million people a year are now having therapy in this country. And I think it raises questions of social control far more than it did. But thank you very much for coming. If it also, just to plug one other thing, there was talk about how what happens in the public sphere happens in the private sphere. And there will be a conference at the University of Oxford by the UPCA on the first Saturday in December, which is looking at what future, long-term and open-ended therapy in the public service, but also then what people are feeling about it in the private service. That's the UPCA conference, first Saturday in December. So thank you very much for coming. Could you also join me with thanking the panel for coming this week?